I'll ask Nathan now if you could go ahead and read for us verses 14 through 24.
Daniel 2, 14 through 24. Then Daniel replied with discernment, with discretion and discernment to Arioch, the captain of the king's bodyguard, who had gone forth to slay the wise men of Babylon. He said to Arioch, the king's commander, "For what reason is the decree from the king so urgent?" Then Arioch informed Daniel about the matter. So Daniel went in and requested of the king that he would give him time in order that he might declare the interpretation to the king. Then Daniel went to his house and informed his friends Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah about the matter, so that they might request compassion from the God of heaven concerning this mystery, so Daniel and his friends would not be destroyed with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. Then the mystery was revealed to Daniel in a night vision. Then Daniel blessed the God of heavens. Daniel said, "Let the name of God be blessed forever and ever, for wisdom and power belong to him. It is he who changes the times and the epochs. He removes kings and establishes kings. He gives wisdom to wise men and knowledge to men of understanding. It is he who reveals the profound and hidden things. He knows what is in the darkness, and the light dwells with him. To you, O God of my fathers, I give thanks and praise, for you have given me wisdom and power. Even now you have made known to me what we requested of you, for you have made known to us the king's matter." Therefore Daniel went into Arioch, whom the king had appointed, to destroy the wise men of Babylon.
Actually, that's good. I'll actually stop you there at verse 23. All right, thank you. So we have Arioch, who is tasked with carrying out the king's orders, and he comes to take Daniel and his three companions to death row, essentially. And now, where many would have panicked, you know, including me probably, Daniel instead is able to talk Arioch into taking him to the king instead, right? So rather than panic, Daniel actually saw this perhaps as an opportunity. An opportunity to introduce King Nebuchadnezzar to the only true and living God. And notice how confident Daniel is in verse 16, right? He went in and requested of the king to give him time. You know, the king was in a rage with the rest of his wise men, and he ordered their death. And in spite of this, Daniel remains calm and he remains confident because he trusts in God, right? Regardless of the outcome, Daniel has his faith and his trust in God. Now, you know, at this point, all of the king's other wise men would probably have turned to maybe crystal balls or astrology or animal entrails or some other fabricated method to try and divine what the king had dreamt and the interpretation. But Daniel, of course, doesn't do that. You know, instead, he and his friends go to prayer. Right? Daniel knows that they only have one recourse. And that is prayer. Because Daniel was in total agreement with the magicians on this point, right? Only God could reveal the thoughts and dreams of the king, right? Only God could do that. You know, while no human being could ever tell the king the contents and the interpretation of his dream, God could. You know, in verse 11, the wise men say only God could do this, but they don't dwell among men. In fact, Daniel knows that there is, in fact, a God, right? There is one God who does dwell with men, and that is Daniel's God, right? The one and only true God. And then you have this beautiful picture of prayer, right? Of these four young men, these men still on their teens, united in prayer. This was a life and death crisis, and they are pleading with God to have mercy on them and to preserve their lives. And then after that, the vision is revealed to Daniel. And then he prays again to give thanks. Now, as you look at this prayer, you know, what are some of the things that Daniel describes in regards to God's aspect, right? What are some ways that Daniel describes God here in this prayer?
He says, "To God belongs wisdom and power," in verse 20.
Yeah, and that's kind of the two, and then he elaborates on that, right? So God is powerful. God controls history. God controls nature. Right? God created the universe, and he keeps it operating. God is the creator and the sustainer and sovereign of the universe. And yet at the same time, God knows our every thought and our every dream. God counts the hairs on our head. And we worship a God who maintains galaxies and yet knows when a sparrow falls. And then the second thing, as Stuart pointed out, right, is God's wisdom. Oftentimes, I'm sure we like to think we are wise, but any wisdom we have really comes from God, either what God has told us or what God has given us. What other comments or questions through verse 23?
We also read that he removes kings and establishes kings. And perhaps the major theme of Daniel is how God rules in the kings, in the kingdoms of men.
Absolutely. And we're going to see that in, later in this chapter, how Daniel will tell Nebuchadnezzar that, right? It is not through your power that you are king, but it is through God's grace, right, that Nebuchadnezzar is in power.
And
what other comments or questions?
It also says in verse 21, he changes the times and the epochs. And just going through the whole Old Testament and the history of God's people, you can really see that it is God who is in control. And so even today, God is in control, and he has this power, he has this wisdom. But, a lot of times we can see the world getting chaotic around us, and probably at this moment in Daniel's life, it may be chaotic with this, decree to kill him and his friends and the other wise men, but ultimately God is in control. And that's important for, Daniel during this time and for us to remember today.
Absolutely. Great thought. Well, let's go ahead and read on. And so Cameron, if you can actually start in verse 24, and if you can read all the way through verse 35.
Therefore, Daniel went into Arioch, whom the king had appointed to destroy the wise men of Babylon. He went and spoke to him as follows. Do not destroy the wise men of Babylon. Take me into the king's presence, and I will declare their interpretation to the king. Then Arioch hurriedly brought Daniel into the king's presence and spoke to him as follows. I have found a man among the exiles from Judah who can make the interpretation known to the king. The king said to Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, are you able to make known to me the dream which I have seen and its interpretation? Daniel answered before the king and said, as for the mystery about which the king has inquired, neither wise men, conjurers, magicians, nor diviners are able to declare it to the king. However, there is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries, and he has made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will take place in the latter days. This was your dream and the visions in your mind while on your bed. As for you, O king, while on your bed, your thoughts turn to what would take place in the future, and he who reveals mysteries has made known to you what will take place. But as for me, this mystery has not been revealed to me for any wisdom residing in me more than in any other living man, but for the purpose of making the interpretation known to the king, and that you may understand the thoughts of your mind. You, O king, were looking, and behold, there was a single great statue. That statue, which was large and of extraordinary splendor, was standing in front of you, and its appearance was awesome. The head of that statue was made of fine gold, its breast and its arms of silver, its belly and its thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, its feet partly of iron and partly of clay. You continued looking until a stone was cut out without hands, and it struck the statue on its feet of iron and clay and crushed them. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, and the gold were crushed all at the same time and became like chaff from the summer threshing floors. And the wind carried them away so that not a trace of them was found. But the stone that struck the statue became a great mountain and filled the whole earth.
So at last we have this dream. And in verse 25, incredibly, It would seem that all by himself, Arioch has solved the problem, right? Notice how he takes all of the credit for this. You know, maybe this has something to do with the reward that was mentioned back in verse 6, right? But Arioch comes in and says, I have found a man among the exiles who can make known the interpretation, right? And it's interesting, though, to note that Arioch's complete confidence in Daniel, right? Notice how he shows no doubt that Daniel will be able to interpret the king's dream. And I imagine, had Daniel not been able to do that, Arioch probably would have had some repercussions as well by making such a bold claim. And so here we see already that Daniel must have already made quite an impression on Arioch. And then you have Daniel, who boldly tells the king that he has all the answers, right? Well, not at all. You know, unlike Arioch, who sought the credit, Daniel immediately gives the credit to God. In fact, he tells the king really the exact same thing that the other wise men had told him previously. You know, no magician or astrologer or conjurer could accomplish what the king had asked. Only the one true God could, right? And in fact, it was that one true God that had given Nebuchadnezzar this dream for the purpose of revealing future events, right? To revealing of what would take place in the latter days. And so now we have this dream, right? Nebuchadnezzar sees a statue. Actually, before we actually look at the dream, you know, oftentimes as we look at apocalyptic literature, as we see these visions, this will become even more necessary when we get to chapter 7. But try to envision, right, what it was that Nebuchadnezzar saw, right? See what he saw. These visions are meant to be seen, and so it's often helpful if you can have that imagination and try and envision that within your mind. And so Nebuchadnezzar sees a statue, and this statue was made up of four different parts, right? So it was a head of gold, it was the arms and chest of silver, the belly and thigh of bronze, and legs of iron, and feet of iron mixed with clay. And if you have the workbook handy, I included an artist's rendition or an artist's rendering of what that statue could have possibly looked like. Of course, we won't know. But it's often helpful, again, to kind of see and envision what that may have looked like. And so if you have that handy, you can take a look at that. And then as the king is looking at this statue, he sees this stone, right? And this stone is one that was not cut with human hands, right? So I imagine this was cut from some mountain. And the stone comes down and it smashes the feet to the point that the whole statue comes toppling down. And then the rest of the statue all turns to dust at the same time, right? It annihilates the statue. And then finally, the king sees the stone become a great mountain that filled the earth, right? So can you picture that? And so at last, the contents of this dream are revealed, and you can maybe imagine the king's astonishment, right? The king's reaction when Daniel started describing his dream, right? I can't imagine what would happen if someone just started describing my dream. And you can imagine maybe the astonishment of the wise men, right? Of the other wise men, and maybe even their relief. You know, Daniel, I think, just saved their lives. If it weren't for Daniel, Nebuchadnezzar would have had all of them killed. The other wise men had said, you could never be done, right? This is something that had never been asked of anyone. And here was Daniel, an exiled teenager, doing that very thing. Now, we'll read the interpretation here in just a moment, but let's take some time to maybe make some initial observations, right? Now, what are some observations? What are some similarities or some differences that you notice about the parts that make up the statue, right? Stuart?
Well, I was going to say, you know, most of these components are pretty strong components, aside from maybe clay is a little weaker than all the others, but they all have a strength value to them, I'd say.
Yeah, because what are they all made out of, right? They're made out of metal. Clay is definitely the oddball there, but all of these are metals. And what about the value of these metals, right? Is there a difference in how these metals might be valued today? Right, you have the head of gold, which is probably the most valuable in this statue. And then you have silver, which is not as valuable as gold. And then you have bronze, which is even less so. And then you have iron, right? Iron might be the strongest, but it's also sort of the least valuable of the mix. What about this stone, right? What are some observations that you can maybe make of this stone? How is this stone described? You know, its origin, I would say, is definitely supernatural, right? This is a stone that was cut from a mountain without human hands. And so it's definitely supernatural in nature, and it had extraordinary power because it annihilated the statue, right? And not only that, but the scope of this stone, right, was such that it grew into this huge mountain and filled the entire earth. And then in verses 44 through 45, we're going to see that Daniel identifies this stone, this great rock, as the coming kingdom of God. And its development into this huge mountain would symbolize its universal dominion. Ben, did you have a comment or a question?
Yeah, you covered some of it. But as we move forward, you noted it was insignificant. But the power of it, and as we read through the rest of this story, you know, we all worry about things, the well-being of our families, the well-being of the church, what's going on in the world around us. But what's so reassuring about this story as we read, I love this story, is that God is in control ultimately, and he knows what's going to happen, and his will is going to be done. And it is one of the most encouraging, reassuring stories about our place in this world and in life with our God in control and in power. And when we pray to him, he's going to help us. It may not be the way we want, but it's what is going to happen is always going to be for the well-being of his children.
Absolutely. Great thought. Other comments or questions through verse 35?
Yeah, Harper, one thing. If you look at the metals involved, gold, silver, and iron, those were things that were, well, in some cases they were found naturally. They just weren't found out in the open. So when you look at the splendor of gold and the splendor of silver, silver is a little bit lower than gold. And then when you look at iron, you look at that as being a mixture of metals, and you think that, well, the purity of gold and the purity of silver exceeds that of iron. But then suddenly you see a little bit lower down, you see iron mixed with clay, and you know, you can't help but think of what the Jews were thinking in, you know, the first century, that, you know, Lord, will you return unto us the kingdom? And they were thinking of something that was just so wonderful, so splendorous. But instead, we have a Savior who was on this earth. He was of lowly birth. He was born in a manger. And people, you know, did not flock to him because of what he looked like. It was the value that he had. And while in this we see that the stone represents the kingdom, something so common as a stone ends up being something so important to man. So just kind of, you know, paralleling that to the New Testament church, you know, here we have something what many people would call plain, but indeed it's the most important thing. And like you said, it was supernatural that this stone was cut out of the mountain.
Absolutely, and that, you know, kind of reminds me of the chief cornerstone, right? That was cast down. A little bit of an echo there. Nick, go ahead and read for us. Or if you could mute real quick, Nick. There we go. I think the echo was coming from there. Nathan, did you have a comment?
Yeah, I was going to comment on the clay. As we already noted, as you descend the statue, the value decreases, but the strength of the metal increases. And by the time you get to iron, you have perhaps the most, not necessarily the most glorious, but the strongest, most expansive of the four kingdoms. But it almost becomes so powerful that the strength turns to a brittleness that is then shown in how the stone can topple the whole statue. And so again, you got to increase in strength until it almost becomes so hard that it becomes brittle instead of strong.
Yeah, it's a good observation. And so that's the dream. Right, you have the statue, you have the stone, which destroys the statue. And so now let's get the interpretation. And so Nick, if you could read verses 36 through 45.
Daniel 2, 36 through 45. This was the dream. Now we will tell you its interpretation before the king. You, O king, are the king of kings to whom the God of heaven has given the kingdom, the power, the strength, and the glory. And wherever the sons of men dwell, or the beasts of the field, or the birds of the sky, he has given them into your hand and has caused you to rule over them. You are the head of gold. After you, there will arise another kingdom inferior to you, then another third kingdom of bronze, which will rule over all the earth. Then there will be a fourth kingdom as strong as iron, inasmuch as iron crushes and shatters all things. So, like iron that breaks into pieces, it will crush and break all these into pieces. In that you saw the feet and toes, partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, it will be a divided kingdom, but it will have in it the toughness of iron, inasmuch as you saw the iron mixed with common clay. As the toes of the feet were partly of iron and partly of pottery, so some of the kingdom will be strong and some of it will be brittle. And in that you saw the iron mixed with the common clay, they will combine with one another in the seed of man, but they will not adhere to one another, even as iron does not combine with pottery. In the days of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which will never be destroyed, and that kingdom will not be left for another people. It will crush and put to an end all these kingdoms. But it will itself endure forever. Inasmuch as you saw that a stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, and that it crushed the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold, the great God has made known to the king what will take place in the future. So the dream is true, and its interpretation is trustworthy.
So we've come to the climax. You know, all of this was leading up to this point, right? The big reveal. The king had gone through all these threats and through all these promises just so that he could hear and trust in this interpretation. And so what Daniel says is that starting from the top, each part of this statue represented a kingdom, right? An empire, a succession of empires. And he says that Babylon was represented by this head of gold, right? Nebuchadnezzar was this head of gold. And what is said about the empire that comes after Babylon, right? We noted sort of how in this statue, the metal sort of decrease in value. And so Daniel calls out that the empire that would succeed Babylon would be inferior to Babylon, right? Much like silver is inferior to the value of gold. And just as bronze is less valuable than silver, right? So each of these succeeding empires would be inferior to the previous. Now, we aren't told this yet, but later in Daniel, we will see that this second empire was the Medo-Persian Empire, right? The empire of the Medes and the Persians. But what would make the Medo-Persia Empire inferior to Babylon? You know, after all, they conquered Babylon. You know, the empire was actually even bigger than Nebuchadnezzar's empire. One possibility is the fact that, you know, Nebuchadnezzar was considered to be an absolute in his power, right? It had a centralized government and an absolute monarchy, whereas succeeding empires were progressively less so, right? They were larger and they lasted longer, but none of them held the centralized power, right? The totality of power that Nebuchadnezzar did. And so in that sense, they become inferior. But as Nathan pointed out, I believe earlier, is Daniel makes it very clear to King Nebuchadnezzar right from the start who really is in charge here, right? And it is not the king. It is not the king that's in charge. Nebuchadnezzar had been given this rule and his kingdom by God. You know, any power, any might, or any glory that Nebuchadnezzar had was a gift from God. And this was probably a very bold thing to say to the king, right? I think under normal circumstances, had Daniel tried to proclaim, Nebuchadnezzar, your power is not your own, he probably would have been killed for it. But I think after hearing this dream, Nebuchadnezzar was now much more in the mood to listen to what Daniel has to say, right? Because Daniel had just done what no other wise man could have done. And indeed, not even he had done it, but God had done it. And so we have these three or four empires. But notice that this fourth kingdom, this fourth empire, is described in much greater detail than either the second or the third. Perhaps because, as we see, God has big plans for this fourth kingdom. Right? It's described as having greater strength than the previous one, because it would crush and break all the others, as we see in verse 40. But it also has some weaknesses, right? It would have feet of iron mixed with clay. And of course, clay and iron don't mix very well together. And so this kingdom would be intrinsically weak, right? As Nathan said, maybe the bigger they get, the harder it is to manage, and they have these weaknesses, these cracks. And this kingdom would try to unite elements that would just not coalesce together. And so in some sense, this fourth kingdom would be a divided kingdom. But even after all of that description, these four empires, well, they're really not the point of this vision, right? They're not the point of this dream. You know, those are really, in my opinion, right, inconsequential details when compared to this bigger picture. Because the real purpose of revealing this dream was to draw focus to what God was going to do in the days of that fourth kingdom. Right, and we see that in verse 44, right? In the days of those kings, right? He just described the fourth kingdom in great detail. And so now he says, in the days of those kings, right? In the fourth empire, right? God was going to do something. God was going to establish his kingdom. And do we have record of that ever occurring? Well, of course we do, right? We have that in the New Testament. You know, one example is in the second chapter of Acts, where Luke reveals Peter preaching Christ as sitting on the throne of David, right? And Christ Jesus is reigning as both Lord and Christ, right? In Revelation, it describes Jesus as King of Kings and Lord of Lords. We know from the New Testament that God established that kingdom, right, in his king during the days of the Roman Empire. And that's amazing, right? It's amazing because Daniel is prophesying about this some 600 years before this would actually occur, right? 600 years, Daniel is prophesying that God would establish his king and his kingdom, and we have that validated for us in the New Testament. You know, I mentioned in our introduction that there are a number of critics and liberals who were very skeptic about Daniel, because of some of the detailed prophecies, especially in chapter 11. And so they say there's no way Daniel could have written in the 5th century or in the 6th century, right? Daniel probably instead wrote sometime in the second century, right after the event that he predicted. But even then, Daniel is still prophesying about the kingdom that would be established in the days of Rome, and that still is 150 years, you know, beyond the latest dates these skeptics can even apply. And so either way, you have this amazing fulfillment of prophecy. Comments or questions through verse 45?
Harper, I think it would have been very easy for Daniel to have taken credit for this himself and to have reaped the, wealthy benefits and the reward and taken, you know, full credit. Like, I made this known to you, not God. But as we've said, he gives credit where credit is due to God, whose wisdom is so much higher than all the other wise men's and so forth. And that just makes me think of, you know, today, taking a simple conversation and giving glory to God. It can be a great way to start a spiritual conversation. And so here, this interpretation of the dream is to give God the glory, to recognize his power. And similar today, we can, in our conversations, you know, just thank God for whatever he's done for us. I'm not saying he gives us dreams or interpretations of dreams, but just giving him the credit where credit is due to turn a simple conversation into a spiritual conversation.
Absolutely. You know, and God may not give us interpretations of dreams, but he certainly blesses us with wisdom. And it's important for us to recognize that the wisdom we have absolutely comes from God. Ben?
And I don't want to take up too much time, but going back to verse 43, where it talks about what would become Rome, but about the iron and clay, it says, but they will not adhere to one another. And adherence and collectivity and common purpose and common values is something that's important to a country. And you can talk about those things with regard to our country and the world today, but and some of you may enjoy that type of discussion. But what really is important is you go back about the family of God and read Ephesians 4 about the unity of purpose and the unity of the faith and looking out for one another. What Rome lacked is present in God's family. And that's what helps us to withstand and to persevere and endure everything that goes on around us, and to do it with joy and a hope that is beyond understanding. And people in the world around us will lack that, because what we have is from God. That's all I was going to say on that.
God would establish his kingdom, right? And as Ben was alluding to, you know, this is a kingdom, you know, that would never be destroyed. You know, it would never be conquered, and it would never be occupied by another people, right? This was a kingdom that would crush and put an end to world empires, and this is a kingdom that would endure forever. Nathan?
Yeah, and more on what Ben was saying, you know, I think he's exactly right. But part of what makes, Daniel's prophecy so amazing is the fact that he predicted God's kingdom would outlast the Roman kingdom. And no one in their right mind would have ever imagined a small faction of Jews converting to a new religion, forming a group, actually God forming a group, that would outlast the most powerful, glorious empire that had ever been known to man. But that's exactly what God did.
You know, no one probably would have imagined Babylon would not last forever, especially in Daniel's day. And here Daniel is saying boldly to the king, you know, your reign is not going to last forever. You know, oftentimes you see, oh, king, live forever. And Daniel saying, well, you're not going to live forever, right? And Babylon won't, the Babylonian Empire wouldn't last forever. And going back to some of the comments earlier, right, God is sovereign over the nations and kingdoms of men, and he puts in power whom he wills. Let's go ahead and finish the chapter. And so, Stuart, if you could read for us verses 46 through 49.
Verse 46. Then King Nebuchadnezzar fell on his face and did homage to Daniel and gave orders to present to him an offering and fragrant incense. The king answered Daniel and said, surely your God is a God of gods and a Lord of kings and a revealer of mysteries, since you have been able to reveal this mystery. Then the king promoted Daniel and gave him many great gifts, and he made him ruler over the whole province of Babylon and chief prefect over all the wise men of Babylon. Daniel made request of the king, and he appointed Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the administration of the province of Babylon while Daniel was at the king's court.
So you have King Nebuchadnezzar, one who was described as having this total, absolute power, one who had the power to issue these threats and to have his whole court of wise men executed. And you see him falling at the feet of this teenage exile, right? It gives you some sense of the overwhelming experience that Nebuchadnezzar just had, right? This probably would have been a remarkable sight. Imagine all of the other wise men and their fear of the king to see him bow at this teenage exile. I see a phone number go off mute. Was there a comment or a question?
I was just going to offer a comment about verse 46 and how it's a contrast to what Daniel did and saying that everything was by God's power. And Nebuchadnezzar sits there and offers honor and sacrifices and incense to Daniel and not to God.
It's almost like he's worshiping Daniel, right? That's sort of the image that we're given. And you're absolutely right, right? He does offer these great gifts and these incense. And even from the start, though, Daniel, I imagine, by what we know of Daniel, he would not have necessarily accepted that, right? But knowing that he did give that glory and honor to God instead. But you still get, and maybe imagine how overwhelmed Daniel would have been here. But you see really the overwhelming of the king and the experience he just had, right? And maybe he's not so much as worshiping Daniel directly as he is just recognizing the God of Daniel, right? And Daniel being sort of the spokesperson of God. And so perhaps that's his thought. But the end result here is that Daniel not only gets promoted, but he's also able to get Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego promoted as well over the administration of the province of Babylon. And we're going to see maybe some after effects of that. And